Let me just give you a little bit of introduction as to who I am and why it is I have what appears to be numerous titles here. So my name's Joey Cooley. Last year at this time, I was a professor of physics, full professor of physics with tenure at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And on July 29th last year, I picked up and moved to Canada to start the job of executive director at Snow Lab. So I started that on August 1st, and so I've been executive director for less than a year. You are the first class that I have taught since I left SMU. So I'm pretty excited to be back in front of people teaching again. I also have a concurrent appointment with Queen's University now, and at SMU I still hold a position as adjunct research professor because when I left, you can imagine your advisor one day decides that they want to take a different job in Canada and they are just going to up and leave. So I still have a couple of graduate students who are finishing back up at SMU. They have supervision. We have a postdoc, a research professor who's working with them closely. One of them is graduating, going to defend his thesis hopefully in just 2 weeks. So they're finishing up. So that's who I am. So my background is I did my PhD in neutrino physics. I worked on an experiment called AMANDA, and I think you are going to be hearing about that a little later this week, except for now that experiment is called IceCube, and there's the KMNet array, and in Canada, the whole effort to do P1. So I worked at the very early times on that kind of science, and when I graduated from there, I went to MIT, and I worked on the Super K, K2K, or KEK, or K2K. K2K, K-E-K, Super K, Kamioka, so the K2K experiment, and T2K. And then after that postdoc, I decided to take a second postdoc, and I moved across the country to Stanford University, where I worked with Blas Cabrera on the CDMS2 dark matter experiment. And from there, I went to my faculty position at SMU, continuing working on the CDMS program, which is now called Super CDMS. And then, you know, basically last year, I decided to take a little bit of break from academia for a while to work at a laboratory, an underground laboratory, really a super impressive laboratory that does world-class physics. And so you might wonder, why is it that, you know, you would up and leave your job doing research and teaching and all these great things to go to an underground physics laboratory or an underground laboratory at all? And the reason is that world-class science is done in underground laboratories, and it's a diverse amount of science. I don't know about you. I know some physicists really are like, I'm going to find the Higgs. And that was the big thing when I was a graduate student and dedicated to life to looking for the Higgs boson or some other things. But I always was the kind of person who had a hard time making up their mind what to do, because everything seems so interesting. And so part of the appeal of now being able to work in this laboratory is that I get to work on all sorts of physics. Dark matter is like a number one prime type of physics that we need to do underground. Neutrino physics is another one that you need to do underground. Neutrinoless double beta decay or double beta decay experiments need to be done underground. We also do nuclear astrophysics, quantum technology often needs to be done underground, quantum computing, rare, any event, any kind of science where you're looking for a rare process and you need to control your backgrounds, especially cosmic ray radiation, goes underground. There's geophysics that can be done underground, general relativity, underground biology, nuclear security, and the list kind of goes on and on. So I only have four 90-minute lectures, and it's pretty clear to me that I'm not going to be able to do all of this. And so I'm going to just focus on dark matter and neutrino physics and neutrinoless double beta decay, and primarily even in the neutrino sector, kind of sticking closer to the neutrinoless double beta decay and kind of maybe some history of why neutrinos got interesting and why we're doing them underground. Throughout the lecture in the notes, I will try to put some references to papers that are either on the archive or in print or references so that if any one topic that we talk about is more interesting to you, you at least have some resources to get started. Because although I have been doing dark matter for a very, very long time, I've been doing it as an experimentalist. The climate is constantly changing, and what is fashionable and what is possible has changed a lot over the 2 decades that I've been doing dark matter physics. So, all right, so I'm gonna start just by the classical WIMP. This is something where it seems not as exciting, I think, to people anymore because, like, you know, the LHC didn't find supersymmetry. You know, the dark matter experiments up to this point haven't found really concrete evidence of there being, you know, this classical WIMP. But there's still actually quite a bit of phase space out there to explore, and people are building experiments, you know, to probe that phase space. And so it makes a really nice, simple example to start building a foundation off of. And so since nobody else has really talked about dark matter, I think, at this conference, although you did have some cosmology lectures, so I won't go really deep into this, let me just outline roughly why it is that people are interested in particle dark matter. And so to start with, we know that there is this missing mass problem. People have been studying the dynamics of stars, of galaxies, of galaxy clusters for a long time, noting that things don't add up if you're just looking at the amount of visible matter. And there's even stronger evidence that came from rotation curves. Vera Rubin, back in the early 1970s, was a pioneer in that sort of research. And then sort of in the late 70s and early 80s, people started learning how, started observing the first gravitational lens, or at least realizing that what they were seeing was due to gravitational lensing, and then developing that technique further and further. And then there are people who are doing simulations of the large-scale structure of the universe, and how does that large-scale structure even form? When you take all of those different bodies of evidence together, it indicates that there is a missing mass problem. There's a wealth of evidence that a particle solution is a simple and really clean way to solve that missing mass problem. So in my lectures, I'm not gonna focus on any kind of alternate gravity theories or anything. That still is something that there is some research going on, but the majority consensus is that a particle solution is really good. Microlensing has mostly ruled out MACHOs as being a strong candidate for the dark matter, and alternate theories of gravity. Mond had some trouble with the bullet cluster, which some of you might be familiar with that argument. It turns out you can kind of work around that a little bit, but really I think if you try to go back to the CMB and explain the peaks in the CMB structure, it's nearly impossible. Nobody has come up with a solution that is a modified gravity that can explain just how nicely the CMB tells us that there's a dark matter particle solution out there. We know a little bit more too. We know that the dark matter is non-baryonic. This comes from the height of the acoustic peaks in the CMB. It comes from power spectrum, this power spectrum of the density fluctuations, and also from calculations of primordial nucleosynthesis. And our other requirement for dark matter, and the idea that we need behind it, is that it's still here. It's long-lived. We know that it was there in the earlier universe. We know it's still there. So it's stable, it's neutral, it's non-relativistic, and it interacts, we know, via gravity, and I say hopefully a weak force. If it is that dark matter only interacts gravitationally, nothing that I talk about in the next 3 days is probably going to be very relevant for discovering it. But that said, we do think there is a reasonable reason to think that it could interact via a weak force. I'm not going to go into those arguments. I'm not sure if they were gone into at all when you were talking about cosmology and dark matter or anything, but there are standard arguments. If anybody is interested in it, it's freeze out. And then if you go to lighter dark matter, it's something called freeze in. And we can talk about that. So basically the idea is you take all this evidence, evidence we have from the cosmic microwave background, evidence we have from gravitational lensing, evidence from the motion of galaxy clusters, evidence that we have from observing supernova, and evidence from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And when you put it all together, you get a pretty remarkable picture. And that picture tells us that something like 26, 27% of the universe is made up of some kind of non-luminous dark matter, which up to this point, we've only been able to detect through gravitational interactions. And so that makes a pretty interesting and challenging problem to try to address as an experimentalist. So we're not going to cover all of this today, but this is the types of things that we'll be talking about, I envision, over the next three class periods. So basically, I would divide it into two things. One, thinking, how do you design a dark matter detector? And there are considerations that you need to take into account if you want to design a dark matter detector. You need to know something about the expected rates. You have to know things about the background. And you have to know something about the experimental signature that you're trying to detect in order to design it. And then the other aspect would be talking about the types of direct detection searches that people are doing today. So the first question that you have to ask when you start thinking about direct detection searches is, have we already seen a signal? So probably many of you know that there is a collaboration out there, Dama Libra, who for many, many years now has been claiming a positive signal of dark matter that nobody else can confirm. So I think it's important to walk through that and understand, some of, like, what is it that they're claiming and what are the limitations of their claims. Then we'll talk.
You said who?
Dama Libra, D-A-M-A, is the first experiment, and then they upgraded and added more detectors called Libra, L-I-B-R-A, I think. And so together, Dama slash Libra is how they go. Then talking about detecting the scattering of dark matter off a nucleus, like in a target, a detector target. And then I'll talk a little bit how it is that we have visions to look for lower mass dark matter. So right now, like the field of dark matter, I mean, it goes from indirect detections, looking for, dark matter particles either decaying or annihilating somewhere in the cosmos, like at the center of our galaxy, producing secondary particles that you then detect in something like a gamma ray detector. And so those are, well beyond TeV, sort of energies, down to very, very small dark matter, where thinking of the dark matter or doing your calculations and thinking of measuring it as a particle doesn't make sense anymore, and you start to think of it as a wave. So there's an entire continuum there. And it used to be that we kind of had the indirect detection doing the really ultra heavy high mass stuff. And then we had the direct detection experiments that were kind of, say, looking for dark matter 10 GeV, up to a TeV-ish. And then there was like a gap. And then there was the very, very small dark matter. And I think there's someone talking on axions on Friday, so you'll get that. So this is axions. When you start looking for axions and wave-like dark matter, you're starting to get to the point where what you're looking for, the deposits are so small, the energies are so small, the wavelengths are such that thinking of it as a particle doesn't quite work anymore. And so then you go to the axion or axion-like hypothesis. And the cool thing is that because of advances in technology and advances in theory, saying that there's actually interesting things to look for with that technology, we now can kind of cover that continuum from, say, the 10 GeV down to sort of the MeV, KeV scale, where really then you start looking at technologies that are looking more for wave-like dark matter. And I think I just talked through this first slide without showing it to you. But essentially, the idea is that if you're looking at the direct detection, there's all these different techniques that are available now. When I started in looking for dark matter, so I started my career in 2004, And at that time, we literally were looking like 20 GeV to sort of maybe like 100 GeV or so. Like it was a pretty small window. And that would have been with semiconductors. So, but now there's just so much technology out there. There's been so many advances that we really do have this very wide range of energies we look for. Depending on what you're looking for, depends upon, you know, what technology you'd use and how your interactions might be. So we'll start here with the standard WIMP. And so essentially, it's billiard balls. The physics of the standard WIMP is really something that you probably either did, and if you didn't do it, you could have done, perhaps with even first year university physics. So you start by, as I said, assuming that the dark matter is not only interacting through gravity, so that you could potentially be interacting with a nucleus through perhaps a weak force or some other force. It really doesn't matter. So you have a WIMP from your galactic halo that has sort of a velocity of 220 kilometers per second. Okay, so this is thinking about your reference frame here. In this reference frame, you're going to be in the laboratory. You're still, so your velocity is zero. You'll have an elastic collision, and then the WIMP is going to go off in one direction, and you'll get a recoiling nucleus, the target that you hit, in a slightly different direction, and that collision will impart a small amount of energy to that nucleus. And this interaction can occur either through something called a spin-dependent or a spin-independent channel. It turns out, like, that is like the simplest way to think of it. Turns out that actually it could be even more complicated than that. You could come up with an effective field theory. But we're going to drill down into this and take a look at all of it step by step. But the basic idea is that you want to distinguish then events that are actually coming from your WIMP from the overwhelming number of background events that are happening. So as I sort of mentioned, the kinematics of this is rather straightforward. So on the first slide page, there's an archive article that, you know, kind of actually is a lecture notes that go along with this lecture. So if you're interested in that, you can find it online. So if you want to calculate the recoil energy of a nucleus in the center of mass frame, so your initial momentum, P, is just equal to the negative of your kinetic energy. Your final momentum is equal to the momentum transfer. So that's essentially your P prime minus P. So Q minus V. So here, this mu is your reduced mass. So that's the mass of your dark matter particle times the mass of your nucleon divided by the sum of those two. Q in this equation is the momentum transfer. For elastic scattering that happens in the center of mass frame, it's really simple. The momentum, the initial momentum is equal to the final momentum. And so that means that you have Q squared divided by 2 is equal to 1/2 your momentum transfer. So just doing out the math here, that ends up being, so because you end up with a P squared here and a P prime squared here, right? So that's like 2P prime since they're equal. So that's where why the 1/2 sort of goes away. So you end up with P squared minus P dotted into P prime. And then you can just expand this using, you know, your algebra rules, essentially, for dot products in terms of a cosine. If we let V here be the mean WIMP velocity relative to the target, you can then calculate the recoil energy as Q squared divided by 2 times the mass of the nucleus. and just expanding that out using some of the different variables we've defined here, that ends up being your reduced mass squared times your mean WIMP velocity squared divided by the mass of the nucleus times 1 minus cosine theta r. And again, that theta r is that recoil angle. So like I said, this is pretty straightforward physics that you maybe saw in your first or second year of undergraduate physics class, which is what I think kind of makes it really nice. So going forward then, sort of taking these two pieces of information we have from the last slide, and I'm sorry here, I realized just now that I switched notation between a capital R and a little r, they're both recoil. You can just do out your math. So your recoil energy, if you substitute in theta recoil, if you want to say sort of what is the maximum amount that I could get, right? Then you would want your cosine theta r to be equal to minus 1 to get you the maximum. And that would give you the maximum energy that you could get. And then from there, you can come up with an expression for what the minimum velocity that you would need was. And so your minimum velocity, essentially at that point, is just going to be q divided by 2 times your reduced mass. And again, just simplifying things down as you go. All right, so this has a couple of implications. So what this means that if you have a lighter dark matter particle where the mass of your dark matter particle is much less than the mass of your nucleus, you need to have a really large velocity in order to move it, right? I mean, and this makes sense, right? It naturally makes sense. So we considered only the elastic scattering case, but inelastic scattering can further increase the minimal velocity needs. So if you have inelastic scattering going on, that means that in the collision, you're losing energy. So in order to move that nucleus, you need even more energy to make it happen. If you consider the average momentum transfer in elastic scattering between a WIMP and a nucleus, let's say that the case, and here I think I did out the numbers, let's say the case of a 10 GeV WIMP whose speed is 100 kilometers per second. So my momentum then is just the mass times velocity. So put those numbers in, divide, make sure you take care of all your factors of C, and you end up with 3 MeV per C for momentum. So I know this is a really simple example to go through in such detail, but I think it's good to solidify this in your head, because that means that if you're looking at this, and actually I think they're missing a zero here. That means that if your dark matter particle were 100 GeV per C squared, the momentum transfer, actually maybe I did this right, the momentum transfer is 30 MeV. I mean, it's pretty small. So let's think about this number 30 MeV. Can anybody tell me what wavelength corresponds to a momentum transfer of 10 MeV? Does anybody remember what the formula for the de Broglie wavelength is? Now I don't feel so bad about going over this physics with you. I'm like, oh, they're bored to death. Okay, I'm sorry. So H over P or HC over PC, depending on how you like your units. All right, so I pick easy numbers here so you can do it in your head. Yeah. So I got something on the order of 12 picometers. Maybe you got 10, I got 12. Yeah, that same order. Okay. So this is much larger than the size of most nuclei. So this is a good thing, right? So 12 picometers is bigger than the size of most of your nuclei, because what that means is that the scattering amplitudes of individual nuclei will add coherently. Because when this interaction is going on, it should be that you can make the assumption that you don't have to worry about like whether you've got protons or neutrons or how many of each going on due to the size, because it's just so big. So just to give you a comparison, uranium nucleus is like about 8 femtometers. So when the scattering is happening, the dark matter particle is coming in and it's seeing that nucleus as like a single particle, not as a collection of smaller entities, essentially. It doesn't care about the quarks and the gluons, is what I'm trying to say. All right, so now that we know this, let's kind of continue down the rabbit hole. So stepping it up a little bit, now we're gonna add some calculus into our algebra mix. Let's take a look at what a differential event rate might look like for a simplified interaction. So your event rate is a function of the recoil energy. So dr by dE recoil is equal to your total event rate divided by the most probable incident energy, which we usually assume is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, times a kinematic factor, multiplied by an exponent. And so if I were to sort of roughly plot what this looks like, if I take the log of dr dE sub r and plot as a function of our recoil energy, you can see that the differential energy spectrum is featureless. And so the total event rate, then, to get that, I integrate. And so when I integrate this, I end up with R naught. And the mean recoil energy then would just be given as the integral from 0 to infinity of E sub r, dr over dE sub r times d sub r. And then because I'm an experimentalist and not a mathematician, I just cancel this out. Although I know that's not really what you're supposed to do. but I get E naught R if I do the math out properly. You can tell I learned most of my math from a physicist. All right. So that's all fine and dandy, but really what I want to do is calculate the mean amount of this nuclear recoil energy that's deposited in the detector. All right, so if we assume that dark matter mass and the nucleus mass are identical, so again, just picking easy numbers here. So let's just assume that I have a nucleus that has mass of 100 GeV and that my dark matter particle's mass 100 GeV. Our formula, remember, is just this one, E sub naught R. And so that's just 1/2 mass times velocity squared. Okay. Times my kinematic factor. Notice I picked 100 because it's really easy. What's your kinematic factor in this case end up being equal to? Yeah, it's just one. Yeah, I just want to make sure everybody's staying awake. So assuming that the halo is stationary then, the mean wimp velocity relative to the target is about 220 kilometers per second. So we substitute that into our equation. And voila. So we end up with sort of 100 GeV times 0.75 times 10 to the 3 the speed of the light. So that's this 200 kilometers per second divided by 2 gives me 30 keV. So I think I started this lecture by saying the WIMP, when it collides with the nucleus, might give you something like 30 keV of energy. And now we've done out that calculation to show that indeed that happens, you know, in this sort of rough case. All right, but so that was all sort of hand-wavy, back of the envelope, everything's working out. Now we need to get into, we should get into the details, because the model I gave was pretty simple. It's actually, there's actually a number of details. We need to take into account a number of things. First, the dark matter will have a velocity distribution, which is f of v, is the, or where v is your velocity. So it has this velocity distribution. So we have to know something about that. The detector is on the Earth. The Earth moves around the Sun. The Sun moves around the galactic center. That also could add some complication into our calculations. The cross-section depends on the spin of the interaction. So in the simplest case, which I made an argument that we could use the spin-independent interaction, the second simplest case would be a spin-dependent interaction. But it may not even be that simple. It may be more complicated than that. The dark matter scatters on nuclei. Nuclei have finite sizes. So as such, we need to consider whether any form factor corrections need to be taken into account. And those corrections are different for spin-independent and spin-dependent interactions. And then the recoil energy is not necessarily the energy that you're observing. So if you're building a detector, your detector will have some amount of inefficiency in it. And so, so you have to take into account that your detection efficiency for that, say, 30 keV is maybe not 100%. And so all of that comes into account. And then the final aspect is that detectors have certain energy resolutions, and they have certain energy thresholds. So if your dark matter, if that recoiling nucleus ends up depositing too little energy, you might not be able to see it at all, because it may not trigger a detector, not from simple fundamental kinematic principles, but just from a technological standpoint. All right, so sort of the master formula here for dark matter detection. So the number of particles detected is the dark matter flux times the effective area of the target multiplied by the observation time. And so you can see this, I'm just putting as T observation time times N times V, the dark matter number density times its speed, times capital N sub T, which is the number of targets that you have, times the scattering cross-section for that target. We're also going to need to determine the spectrum of the dark matter recoils. This is the energy dependence of the number of detected dark matter particles. All right, so this is the number per recoiling energy. And so taking that differential on both sides of the equation. So this key equation here, you'll see the way that I do my slides if you haven't noticed already. Often if I have a piece of information on this slide that I'm going to carry over to the next slide, I put it in the upper corner. Yes?
At one point, do we start considering detector efficiencies into this number?
Yeah.
Is it going to be an abstraction on top of this number or below this number?
So the detector efficiency, the efficiency for the number that you are actually detecting, would be like a multiplicative efficiency. So like you would figure that your detector efficiency is 95%. Like in the simplest case, you would have to find a way to calculate it. And it may be that your efficiency, and actually it almost certainly is, that your efficiency is energy dependent. And so when you read a paper and you look at it, if the paper will provide you, usually will, oftentimes, I should say usually, things have changed quite a bit, but oftentimes we'll put like an energy correction or a curve in it that tells you what they're assuming their signal or their efficiency is as a function of energy. And so you'll see these curves, and they'll have like the sort of raw data, and then they'll make some cuts, right? So they'll apply selection criteria to that data to clean it up. And so if you were ever to use it as a calculation, this efficiency is a number, it's multiplicative, but it depends on energy. So if you were to see it plotted out, it would kind of like if this is your efficiency with one being at the top versus energy, it generally looks something like that.
So they just show an efficiency explicitly?
They will show an efficiency curve explicitly, or they will have it in, now that we're much more open about sharing data, oftentimes if you go on the archive or wherever it is that the repository of the open data is for that collaboration, it can often be provided there. And if you don't get it there through the results or anything, you know, you can always ask for it from the collaboration. So, yeah. That's a really good question. And I probably answered it more than you wanted, but but I want to make sure that you have the tools you need to do the types of science you want to do. All right, so we need to consider that dark matter particles are described by their local velocity distributions, F sub V. So where V here is the dark matter velocity in the frame of reference of the detector. All right, so in order to do this, we need to integrate all possible dark matter velocities with their corresponding probability density. So V min, which is equal to this, is the minimum speed to reproduce recoil of energy ER. So dN over dR then is equal to T times N sub T. So those things are not velocity dependent. And then you're integrating over, and they're not energy dependent. So you can integrate then over only V times F times d sigma dE sub R times dV. Okay, so kind of note the following. So little n, remember, is a density. So that's a density divided by the mass of chi. And m sub t is the mass of the target over the mass of the nuclei. That gives you the number of targets. And then epsilon here is essentially It's sort of a lot of times we think of it as a live time. It's exposure. So epsilon is exposure. It's time times the mass of your particle. So how long you've been operating your detector times the mass of the particle. And so with these substitutions, I can rewrite that formula now in terms of density, the mass of the nucleus, the mass of your dark matter particle, your exposure, and your exposure. Yes?
For something like Kamiokande, would M, capital MT be literally the whole mass of like the water in Kamiokande, or something else?
Yes, so it would be the mass, the entire mass of whatever is inside, whatever fluid you have inside. So it kilotons or something, and MN sub is the mass of your nucleus, right? So, right. So you have a lot of it. All right. So we have now all the elements we need for our differential event rate. This event rate, the units of it, are events per kilogram or per kV per kilogram per day. I just want to point out the key features. So we have rho naught, that's our WIMP, our local WIMP density. You have the nucleus mass. You have the mass of the WIMP. You have the WIMP nucleon cross-section. You have the WIMP speed distribution in the detector reference frame. And this is all integrated from the minimum WIMP velocity, which can cause a recoil of energy ER, up to infinity. So what you can see from this is that you need input from astrophysics, you need input from particle physics, and you need input from nuclear physics in order to get this differential rate. The nice thing about elastic scattering is that it happens in the extreme non-relativistic case. And in the lab frame, remember, we have this expression still holds. This is an expression we had before. So those are just things to keep in mind. So what we're going to do next is we're going to take this sort of master formula that we have up here, and we're going to break it up component by component and talk about the different considerations that you would take into each piece of this. All right, so, okay, starting with the particle physics. Okay, I am sorry, but this is... This slide repeated itself. But we're still going there. All right. All right, so starting with this. So basically, the event rate then can be found by integrating over all recoils. So then our rate is from the threshold energy up to infinity. We're differentiating integrating over our recoils, and we're integrating that's just carrying forward the integral we had there before. God dang it. Okay, so the scattering cross section takes place in this extreme non-relativistic limit, as we had said. So that means that we can approximate it as being isotropic. Okay, so if it's moving really, really slow, we can make a simplification. So in that case, then d theta over d sigma, or d theta over d cosine theta is a constant, and it would be equal to sigma over 2.
Sorry, why do you need non-relativistic limits?
So if it were relativistic, the math gets a bit more complicated. It can't just be simple. It's not, like, you can't make the simple assumption.
But does this also assume, like, spin independence?
Right now we're not talking about the spin.
Because I imagine that...
We're trying to... Right now I'm going to try, if it helps you to think about a spin independent, that is fine. But I just want to focus on just the particle physics component without taking into account the nuclear physics complications, which we'll talk about next. So in this case, we're just assuming just a simple, spin independent interaction where I don't have to worry about things going on with gluons or neutrons or protons or anything like that. Okay. So that means that we can write ER is equal to the maximum energy, recoiling energy, times 1 plus cosine theta over 2. And that means that dE sub R over d cosine theta is equal to E max divided by 2. And so from that, we can then write, so here is just writing out the chain rule, that d theta over dE sub R is equal to sigma over 2 times 2 over ER max, which of course then just simplifies nicely to sigma over the maximum recoil energy. And so that putting in the substitution of my expression for E max, which we had on a previous slide, we end up with the mass of the nucleus times sigma over 2 mu times V squared. So recall that the momentum transfer for non-relativistic processes can neglect the kinetic energy of the nucleus. So my momentum transfer is just the square root of 2 times m sub m times E sub R. So this is the mass of the nucleus times the recoil energy. And that's on the order of MeV. So again, this is talking and making that argument again about seeing the nucleus as a whole. Spin independent. So the spin independent assumption from a nuclear physics perspective is sort of what you start with, your baseline, easiest assumption that fits all together. So, okay, so heavier nuclei require though, the inclusion of a form factor to account for the loss of coherence. So this is where we start to think about, okay, what if the spin independent, like where does spin independent assumptions break down? Okay, so the WIMP nucleon cross-section potential can be separated into these two things. So d sigma over d e sub r is equal to d sigma over d e sub r for the spin independent plus the spin dependent component, d sigma over dr sd. So the spin independent arise from either scalar or vector couplings to quarks. And your spin dependent components arise from axial vector couplings to the quarks. So if you want to calculate this, you have to add the spin and scalar components together. So when you do this, this then becomes, if I break this down, if I want to take these components and break it down even further, is the mass of the nucleus divided by 2 times the reduced mass squared times v squared. And then you end up with the spin-independent cross-section times a form factor squared plus the spin-dependent cross-section times an analogous form factor for spin-dependent squared. And so the sigmas here are the particle theory, and then the form factors here are the nuclear structure. So the form factor essentially encodes the dependence of the momentum, dependence of the interaction on the momentum transfer. All right, so starting from here, let's just take a look at each one of these terms individually. And we won't go too much into depth of it. I am not a nuclear theorist by any way, but it's important to know. So now, what do you use for these form factors? So these are, there's like a whole area of physics that just, you know, thinks about and works on form factors. What we do is we just take a common one that's used. So for spin-independent interactions, the Wood-Saxon form factor is one that's often used. And so the form factor, I'm just going to throw this up here both. So the form factor depends on J1, a spherical Bessel function, the momentum transfer Q, which we've seen before, R1, which is the effective nucleus radius, and something S called a nuclear skin thickness that's on the order of a femtometer. And so we're not going to go too much further with this, but you could kind of plot this. So if you plot your form factor squared versus your recoil energy, so this just comes from one of the standard papers, for different types of targets that people have considered using for dark matter in the past, neon, fluorine, sodium, argon, germanium, xenon, iodide, you can see that all of these have quite interesting shapes and different shapes and forms. All right, so now taking a look at spin-dependent interactions. So spin-dependent interactions, in this case, more precise calculations have been carried out for a small number of nuclei. So this includes contributions from the nucleon. And the form factor has what you can see here, sort of three parts. There is the part that can be represented as being due to the proton, one that's due to the neutron, and an interference term. So this is your interference term, and I forget if 0, 0 or 1, 1, I forget which one is the proton and which is the neutron. I would take a guess, but I'd probably get backwards. The point being, I guess you could do it out with the math if you calculate out your a squared to figure out which one is which, your a not squared. But anyway, So S sub zero here, so S sub ER you can see, you know, written out here in detail. S sub zero is the zero momentum transfer case. So you take this more complicated formula that has all the contributions from proton, neutron, and cross terms, and divide it by the zero momentum form factor. So what does this leave us with? So for spin independent, you end up with looking at the particle physics aspect of this, so the sigma zero SI. What you can see about this term is that you have a factor or a term that couples to the proton and a term that couples to the neutron. Both of them, in most models, F sub N and F sub P, they're four scalar fermion coupling constants, and in most models, they're equal to each other. They're analogous to Fermi's constant, G. And so so if F sub N and F sub P are essentially the same, what you can see is that the scattering then for in the spin independent case adds coherently with A squared. So when people say that, that is why. In the spin dependent case, it's a bit more complicated. Dependencies for your cross section depend on the Fermi constant. It depends on the nuclear angular momentum and on coupling constants to either the proton or the neutron. And so in the spin dependent case, your cross section scales with the spin of the nucleus. And as such, you don't have this coherent effect anymore. All right, so if it is then, I feel bad, I can hear people writing, so I'm just going to take a pause, breathe.
So if you don't have a coherent effect,
yes.
What does this mean? You
give up?
No. You deform the nucleus? Is this what's happening?
You do what? You deform?
Does this deform the nucleus?
You know, I had never really thought of it in that way because really when these interactions happen, right, it's not like the dark matter particle comes in and stops, right? Like it starts chain reactions of things, and so I've not ever really thought, and I don't have an answer for you as far as like the deformation of the nucleus or thinking about it, like I just have never considered that. It might, maybe. I mean, there's a lot of subtle things that go on that, but I am not positive. All right, so so here's our master spin-dependent formula again, and you were asking about spin-dependent. So what does this mean to me as an experimentalist? It means that if I am putting my boots in the camp that the spin-dependent case is the way that we're going to discover dark matter, and this is the thing I want to go after, it means that I need to pick a target that's favorable. Usually that would mean one that has a free, if you will, an extra neutron or an extra proton that's not paired in some way. So I look for places where these sort of expectation values so these SPs and SNs are higher. And from there, so I sort of just balance the odds and I find things like xenon 129 can be pretty nice. Iodine, fluorine. So you pick your material, you pick your target partially based on what you can get your hands on and that you can actually use, and secondly, what properties it has. So there's also this other thing. So that was sort of the particle physics aspects and nuclear physics aspects that go in. And you can see there's a lot of uncertainties in these things, right? A lot of places where there's room to gain more understanding. So If you also want to like transfer this like into an event rate in your detector, you also have to know something about the halo. You have to take into some assumptions. And so a simplified model is that's used by most people, most experiments when they're quoting the results, is just the, sort of a, what's called the standard halo model. And so the idea is that WIMPs are distributed in an isothermal spherical halo with a Gaussian velocity distribution. So that means it's Maxwellian. The speed distribution is related to the local circular speed by the square root of 3/2 VC. The density is taken to be 0.3 GeV per C squared. And particles with speeds greater than the escape velocity aren't gravitationally bound. And so the speed distribution can't truly be just Maxwellian. It actually ends up being truncated. And usually it's truncated with an escape velocity of 650 kilometers per second. So a fun break exercise that I like to try to do is calculating the density of WIMPs in your work area. And so this is my group the Friday before we went on spring break, when everything shut down, like the world shut down after this. This was the last, because at that point, the world hadn't shut down yet. It was like, hey, there's some cases in California, and the university's telling us, maybe you should take your books home with you, because I'm not sure if we're going to come back to in-person instruction. One of my group members, you can see, was already prepared for that. She was already working from home, and so this was our last day in the lab. Okay, so the dark matter density, remember, 0.3 GeV. Okay, pick your favorite mass dark matter particle. 60 GeV was always the classic favorite. And then as like lighter mass models, various things came. 5 GeV became more exciting at one time. Both of them are good because you can do a comparison. So what does that give you for a number density? So assuming I did my math right, you either get 60,000 particles per cubic meter for a 5 GeV WIMP, or 5,000 particles per cubic meter for a 60 GeV WIMP. And by the way, you should always check my math. My students would tell you that. Like, I like to lie with math a lot. So how many dark matter particles are there then in a 2-liter bottle? Oh, I'll give you a hint. They came up with 120 or 10.
Because it's a 2-liter bottle.
Ah, yes.
Two.
Okay, see? Okay. But, okay, so that was kind of fun, and it was a real simple calculation, right? But maybe it really isn't that simple. It's funny. I always want to say it's like in the last few years, but really pre-pandemic in the last few years, the effective field theories started to become very popular, and people started thinking about, well, maybe if we're doing these dark matter interactions and stuff, it's not simple enough just to think spin independent or spin dependent, that really we need an effective field theory that considers next the leading order operators. And that can occur if you put together an effective Lagrangian that describes WIMP nucleon interactions. Now, this is something I can honestly tell you I think is really interesting. And the part about this that I find interesting is that there are a number of talks on this, a number of papers on this. But essentially, it boils down to 14 operators that rely on a range of nuclear properties in addition to the spin-independent and spin-dependent cases. So that means it's like 16 operators. And they combine in such a way, you can combine these in such a way that the WIMP nucleon cross-section depends on 6 independent nuclear response functions. One of them is the spin-independent, one of them is the spin-dependent case, and 3 of them are velocity-dependent. So two of these pairs interfere, and that interference results in 8 independent parameters that can also be probed. And so this is the first paper that I'm aware of that came out on this topic, and these are references to a number of papers for if people want more details. I'm going to give you a quick kind of overview of what this looks like without going into the detail that these papers do. But some of these are, this is the theoretical paper, and a couple of these are actually experimental papers where people have taken experiments, limits from certain experiments and applied to what does that mean for effective field operators. So these are your operators from that effective field theory. So it parametrizes the WIMP nucleus interactions in terms of 14 operators. So the relative velocity between the incoming WIMP and the nucleon in this notation is V perpendicular. Q is the momentum transfer as usual. S sub X or chi is the WIMP spin, and S sub N is the nucleon spin. So in addition to this, each operator can independently couple to protons or neutrons. And so, and then just a note that O2 is not considered because it can't arise in a non-relativistic limit. I don't know the details of why, but it's noted. So so that opens up a whole realm of things. And so so we can take a look at what does this mean for different targets. So let's say here where you're taking fluorine with constructive interference and you're taking one of the operators, you plot this. The whole point here is I don't want to get into the details of each of these models, but just showing you that for four different targets, silicon, germanium, xenon, and fluorine, depending on what operators become relevant or not relevant, depends on which of these atoms, if you will, which of these elements, which of these targets is going to be the one that dominates. And so the idea is that if we ever do see dark matter, and if we have experiments that have multiple targets, okay, or we have multiple experiments with different targets, depending on what rates we're seeing in each detector, depending on their size, you might be able to say something about the effective theory, field theory, behind these interactions. So you may be able to say a little something about the nuclear physics once you start seeing dark matter if you have different targets, so you can probe the different operators. All in all, though, going back to our simple spin-independent model, I think what you can see is that the event rates are extremely low. So elastic scattering of a WIMP deposits a small amount of energy into a nuclear recoiling nucleus on the order of tens of keV. If I were to plot the rate here, this is the rate in a 10 kilogram experiment. It's the rate that you would see in a 10 kilogram experiment in 1 year versus the threshold energy of that experiment. It looks rather bleak, doesn't it? That's one event, okay?
Kilograms, I guess.
Yeah, 10 kilograms. You need more than, you need a big mass. In addition to it being a low event rate, this is featureless. Like, there's no feature here that you're going to use to try to identify that you see something. The event rate's very, very low. And the radioactive background, the background from radioactivity of most materials is higher than your event rate. I mean, honest to God, I spent several years trying to find the cleanest copper you could find, right? Like, so this is the whole need for that exposure. You need large exposure. So you need big amounts of mass. You need to be able to operate the detectors very stably over a long period of time. All right, so if I go to the low mass, say now that I want to, let's say I want to do a low mass dark matter search. So let's say that last plot was for 100 GeV WIMP. This one here is for a 5, so this here is a 5 GeV WIMP. So what you can see here is that if I lower my threshold and I lower the mass of my WIMP, I make things even bleaker. Yeah. So
it's more advanced.
This is per, I realize now that as I look at this, this is events per kilogram per year. So you gotta take a factor of 10 off on each of them. Cool. Yeah. So, yes.
You specified that these cross-sections, well, these event rates as a function of threshold energy or features. So can you describe a little bit about what's the importance of having some features in your actual events as a function of threshold energy and why that might contribute to your detection?
Yeah. So actually, I'm trying to think here. I'm trying to think if I have a plot in the future that talks about it.
It's kind of like...
Yeah. Okay. So the problem is, okay, is that... Once we look at some data, it will become more obvious. But a lot of your backgrounds look like this. Kind of in general, or that, or, you know, I mean, they're like, or worse yet, they do this, okay? And if your signal, like this is as energy, this is your event rate. All right, so these are the types of backgrounds that you have going on. And now if you're adding on to that, you know, something that is just flat and featureless like this is your event, that's not so nice. If I had something, or, yeah, and this was, is this on a, I think that's on a log plot. Yep, it's a log plot. So really, sorry, I was like, really, it's doing this, right? So if I had something, though, that did that, right, and I were looking at my background, like this peak here would be a lot easier to see as I was trying to sort out things, or if I did a stack plot. So the problem is because this is, like, this is an exponential plot, and it's flat that way, it really means that it looks like this, and it's hard to pull that signal when your backgrounds are going like that.
Sorry, could you just go back one slide?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so this is a much higher mass than on the...
Yes, the difference is the mass. So if you have a higher mass, you have a better chance. Because of your recoil energy, your threshold energy. Let me take a look here. Experimental threshold, KeV. So the thing is, look here, this is the threshold. This is 10 KeV. This is 10 KeV.
Yes, but
okay,
it's,
yeah.
So it's on the following plot, there's much more events.
I suspect, actually, let me look closer again. I suspect I picked something bad here. The cross-section here is 10 to the minus 42, and I bet the cross-section here is different.
Yeah, okay.
Yep, 10 to the minus 45. My bad for making this not trivial. But... Okay, so, but the idea would be that this is squeezed. So I should pick a better plot for the previous slide next time I give this talk. All right.
Then it works out because per 10 kilograms, you get like order magnitude 3, and then 3 orders in the cross section.
Yeah. All right, so I like this plot. This is actually from, so since we're doing undergraduate physics in this session, I knew that was gonna happen in advance. I predicted it. And so I pulled out this research paper from an undergraduate. So this is not the undergraduate portion of it, but this is the expected WIMP spectrum, which I painted for you over there. This is the measurement of a banana using gamma rays. I think you see the problem that we have here, right? I mean, so the event rates, the ideas is that, even things like bananas are super radioactive and just sort of your ordinary stuff. And so we go through an extreme amount here. So one of the saving graces that we have, if we're looking for a WIMP interaction on a nucleus, is that these are nuclear recoils and these are electron recoils. So the idea of being able to distinguish between a electron recoil or a nuclear recoil can be a real key if you're trying to reduce backgrounds from that level. If you happen to be looking for a WIMP that interacts with an electron, then all you can do is just reduce as much as you can and set limits. But you do get some discrimination if it is that your dark matter candidate will interact with the nucleus. So on that, let's talk a little bit about signals. So I did kind of paint a very bleak picture for what trying to find a signal might look like in one of these detectors. There are actually a couple of handles that we have on dark matter signals that you could perhaps take advantage of if you were trying to build a dark matter detector. One of them is time dependence. So the Earth orbits around the Sun, and so the Earth is rotating around the Sun as the Sun is traveling towards the star Cygnus in our galaxy, so as it moves in our solar system. And so this leads to a time dependence. It's an annual modulation in the differential rate. So the Earth's speed with respect to the galactic rest frame is highest in June and lowest in December. And so the number of WIMPs that you would see would modulate over the course of the year as you're sort of going into the WIMP wind, or if the WIMP wind is at your back, if you want to think of it that way. So we expect to see a peak of events. If you were going to detect a lot of dark matter events, you would expect to see a peak in the summer, and you would expect to see a minimum in the winter. So basically, since the Earth's orbital speed is so much smaller than the Sun's circular speed, we can tailor expand the differential rate to a first order approximation. And I also put up a paper here where if you want to go through all the details of how these calculations work, Katie Fries and her collaborators had done that a number of years ago. And so if you take the period T to be 1 year and the phase T naught to be 150 days, the differential rate would peak in December for small recoil energies and in the summer for larger ones. And so essentially, to see the variation in this, you need something like 1,000 events. So this seasonal effect roughly is a 2% effect. So in addition to, essentially you getting to have the seasonal variation of the number of events that you would see in your detector, just due to the motion. There's another signal modulation that you could look for, and that's the fact, it's a directional dependence. And so, again, just to orient you here, this is the sun moving in our galaxy towards Cygnus. And this is the Earth rotating about the sun. And our axis for rotation around the sun is essentially at an angle of 60 degrees from this plane, this motion of plane. All right, so that's important because what you can imagine is, so if this is us moving, right, and we have then dark matter particles, you know, thinking if we're looking at a wind of them as we're moving, so if we think of ourselves as moving through them, this means that, okay, so now taking the Earth and having it rotate on its axis as we're moving towards towards Cygnus, what will happen is that over the course of a day, your detector is going to be on different locations in this plane, right? And so that means that the direction that the events are coming in will have different orientations at different times of the day in your detector. So this requires a little bit of visualization as you kind of imagine this is up, and so at this time, at 0-100 hours, you're almost going straight down, and then at 1200 hours, you're going closer to parallel. Does that make sense, like in your detector? And so so the number of nuclear recoils along a particular direction in the lab frame will change over the course of the day. If you assume the standard HALO model, this is given by this formula here. So you can see some of the key things are the things that we've already looked at in the past, but now we also have the orbital Earth velocity parallel to the direction of solar motion that comes into account. And also over here, gamma, which is the angle between the recoil and the direction of the solar motion. So a detector measuring the axis and direction of the recoil with good resolution would only need a few tens of events to distinguish dark matter from an isotropic background. So this is there are detectors that use both of these techniques or have tried to use both of these techniques. DAMA Libra, the annual modulation, is what they use. More recently, there have been results from the COSINE experiment and the ANIS experiment that have also been using that same annual modulation technique and have not been able to confirm the DAMA signal. This technique here is used by an experiment called DRIFT and an experiment in the past that was called DMTPC. So there have been a couple of experiments that have tried this technique as well. It's one of the techniques that hypothetically, I'm sure you have heard, and if not, you will hear about it some more tomorrow or the day after, as we're marching down in cross-section of what we're able to detect for dark matter, eventually we get to a point where neutrinos from either the sun, the atmosphere, supernova explosions, et cetera, become a background for these detectors. This is one technique that has been also resurrected as a way to address that. Perhaps with this technique, you could actually, you know, distinguish, say, your neutrinos coming from the sun versus neutrinos or versus dark matter particles. So it is something that people think about. Yes?
These kind of detection experiments, are they limited more by the determination of the axes and direction uncertainty or more by the determination of radiant energy composition?
So the limiting factor overall is going to be that these tend to be gaseous detectors to some extent. And so they would have to be very large in order to detect to detect dark matter candidates that are interacting with the cross sections that we assume they will have to, like, right? So they would have to be very large, right? So it's kind of dominated by that. So, you know, it could be technology. So you'd have to either have, you know, lots of smaller modules, and then that brings on issues of backgrounds and efficiencies. I mean, you know, the ideal detector, you know, might be as large as you can build it, because every edge in all of these experiments, every wall is a source of problems. And so you always have to fiducialize. And so if you're fiducializing smaller, it's more efficient from a target perspective to do that. But, you know, the other thing, like the readout, I mean, I think there's a lot of technology aspects of it that can be overcome, thinking about different types of readout schemes, things like that, that could be developed. Ultimately, I think the size will be the hardest factor to overcome.
So could you tell us a bit more about the Diamond-Libra experiment?
I would love to tell you more about it. And I actually do have slides on it for another day. We could skip ahead maybe to it, but I see what's coming up next as a big subject that's near and dear to my heart, and I hope will not bore you too much. How many of you are experimentalists? All right, who's a theorist? Oh, you guys are gonna love this next section. but the next topic, and I think we could start it a little bit, is actually backgrounds. They're really, really important. And I recently was at CAP Congress last week, here in Canada, and I saw the most delightful talk by a professor who works on ATLAS on the LHC, and she was talking about glue, like literally glue, in components because of different properties that make things very difficult because the tools you're working with are limited. I want to talk about backgrounds first, and then I'm going to, after we get done with that, I think, if I remember my slides correctly, we are actually moving on to Diamond-Libra, and we'll talk about their results. Let me leave you, since I have 5 minutes, to at least just give you an introduction to thinking about backgrounds. So what, think of all the backgrounds that possibly could bother these experiments. There are backgrounds that come from environmental radioactivity. So this includes airborne radon and its daughters. And by the way, all of these things I talk about for backgrounds here as related to dark matter experiments are the same types of things that get in the way of neutrinoless double beta decay experiments as well. Most everything we cover in this section is equally applicable to neutrino experiments, neutrinoless double beta decay, any kind of rare search. You could have radio impurities in the materials that are used for the construction of the detector or the shield. You can get radiogenic neutrons with energies below 10 eV. So this could be neutrons that come from alpha N and fission reactions. You have cosmic rays and all of their secondaries. You have activation of detector materials near the Earth's surface. So for example, super CDMS, these germanium detectors, the germanium gets activated when it's at the surface of the Earth, puts the germanium in an excited state, and then when you put it back underground again, it relaxes and it gives off a gamma ray right in the energy region of interest that you are not interested in our energy region of interest. And so, with a significant enough half-life that you don't just want to wait for it. So all of these things are things that people think about, and our experiment is not the only one that does. You know, recently it was the Domic experiment who realized that actually you can get silicon to also be activated in such a way that it has a background. And I think it's the argon in the silicate that they make the silicon detectors out of, and it gets hit, you know, by cosmic rays. It's like just crazy. This is all I can say. Like every time you think you have a handle on it, guess what? Something else comes up. And it's because you're pushing the boundaries of your knowledge. And so since we have 5 minutes left, let me just bring you a brief reminder of radioactive decay. This is something that I think everybody learns at some point in their life, but I think a lot of people can't remember when or where or what class. I'm pretty sure for me, it was high school, but and I don't remember doing it anytime I was an undergraduate or a graduate student until I started working in dark matter. Okay, so activity is decays per unit time, and it's measured by the decay of a radio nuclide. So, so your activity, A, is dndt, and that's equal to gamma divided by, or gamma times n, so your decay constant times the total number of radioactive elements. The decay constant is the probability that a radioactive atom will decay. So it's equal to the natural log of 2 divided by the half-life. The number of atoms of the radioisotope present is given by Avogadro's number divided by the atomic mass of the radionuclide times the mass of the radionuclide. And abundance refers to the relative properties or relative portions of stable isotopes of an element. And abundance is something that we'll come back to when we talk about neutrinoless double beta decay experiments again, because there the abundance, the idea of how much of that specific, you know, isotope remains in that element becomes a really important feature of trying to pick what you would make your target. All right. I think this is a good place to stop because it's 2 minutes before 6 o'clock. So the next thing, as you might guess, is event signatures and then moving into detector responses. And then I want to talk a bit about in depth, kind of at the same level that I was kind of pulling apart, what are all the aspects that go into your event rate? I want to pull apart the different types of things that people, and by people I mean PhD carrying and their students, physicists, do to try to really ensure that the detectors they're making are really state of the art and can do these measurements. Because it's really an impressive enterprise that we're getting down to. You know, the Large Hadron Collider, it's big, Atlas, CMS, they have a lot of stuff going on. But these dark matter experiments that people are trying to do now, I mean, heroic efforts go into, you know, trying to catalog even what vendor has what type of material and understanding and appreciating this. So when you experimentalists have a physicist that someday is like, no, you can't do that. Oh my God, those two events are for sure back on. You at least can kind of get a perspective of why it is that that the experimentalists are so staunch in their beliefs that what they're doing is right, and perhaps their beliefs why every signal that seems to prop up is probably from a background. And I know from a theoretical perspective, every signal that seems to crop up is some new way to sharpen their tools to be able to discover something new and exciting. And my hope is that at the end of this, you know, when I leave Friday, that you as theorists and experimentalists come a little bit closer together to be able to understand each other's art, because I think the best physics is done when we meet at that intersection of what is possible and what we have to be careful about when we're thinking about what's possible. So thank you very much, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.